Hello, and welcome to our first Implementation Insights podcast of 2026. I'm Sarah McFerrin, a member of the ISSB's technical staff. In this episode, we'll take stock of the materials available to help you deepen your understanding of the ISSB standards, highlight some of the other ways we are supporting implementation of the ISSB standards, including understanding and responding to application challenges. And we'll look ahead to our plans for 2026, including how we will support preparers who are applying the standards for the first time. I'm joined today by ISSB Vice Chair Sue Lloyd and my fellow technical staff member, Greg Bartholomew, who works on supporting implementation of S1 and S2. Sue, perhaps you can start us off with outlining how the ISSB will be helping support implementation in 2026.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. So a number of jurisdictions are applying ISSB standards actually for the first time in 2026. So, for example, we've got companies in Australia who are in the midst of their climate reporting using the Australian equivalent of our IFRS S2 standard. So to prepare, we've been pretty busy building out a suite of materials to deepen understanding and responding to questions and application challenges that we have received, including through making some targeted amendments to IFRS S2. Perhaps, Greg, you've been super closely involved with this work. Perhaps you want to talk to us about the suite of educational materials that we've now made available.
Sure. Thanks, Sue. So over the last year and a half since issuing the standards, we've been working to develop this suite of education materials to support preparers in applying our standards. So we have several materials available on the application support section of our website, as well as accessible through the Knowledge Hub. And in considering the materials that should be developed, the aim was really to focus on the hot spots of IFRS S1 and S2. And these were areas where preparers and other stakeholders that they told us that they needed the most help. So in this episode, we'll look at some of the latest materials that are available to help deepen the understanding of S1 and S2. Which includes a mix of written materials as well as webcasts. When we talk about education materials, it's important to note that the materials are there to explain, not change, the requirements of ISSB standards. So this means they don't form part of the requirements of ISSB standards, and they don't add to or otherwise modify the requirements in ISSB standards. A question that I get sometimes is, we have a number of materials available, and people ask me, where should I start? So, Sue, when I think of our most important pieces of education material, I think about our guidance on materiality. Would you agree?
It's like trying to choose, being asked who your favorite child is, but yes, she puts me. I'd say yes, absolutely. Our educational materials on materiality are really important because they help to really set out and aid understanding of the fundamental things you need to do to use the ISSB standards and provide your sustainability-related financial disclosures. So we call that materiality guidance, but really it touches on two things. So firstly, how to identify the sustainability-related risks and opportunities that could reasonably be expected to affect companies' prospects over the short, medium, and long term. So basically working out what things you need to report on. And then secondly, undertaken sort of the pure materiality test for those of you familiar with that concept from the accounting standards, which is determining what information about those risks and opportunities is material to investors. And that part of the guidance really helps companies to work out what particular disclosures they need to provide, given their facts and circumstances, about the sustainability-related risks and opportunities they've identified, so what to include in the report. So we published this a while ago now, back in late 2024. And then to help bring that guide to life, we've also got now a webcast series that walks through each chapter of that guidance on identifying sustainability-related risks and opportunities and then disclosing material information about them. And that also is a more accessible way to consume the content chapter by chapter in a presentation-style format. I sometimes think that if you listen to that webcast first and then go and read the written documents, it can be easier to do than reading a document cold.
I agree that's a great one to start with for anyone picking up our standards for the first time. It really helps to explain that the ISSB standards are about providing the information to explain to investors how sustainable a company's business will be over the short, medium, and long term, and the plans to support that. Greg, what's other material you think is particularly helpful?
Yeah, so the next one I'd probably go to is the proportionality webcast in the associated fact sheet. So when developing S1 and S2, a big focus of the ISSB was making sure that the benefits of applying the standards outweigh the costs and that the standards could be applied by a range of different companies across a variety of jurisdictions. Part of how the ISSB did this was making sure that companies can be proportionate in how they apply the standards. So we've developed this webcast to explain the proportionality mechanisms that are in the standards. So the webcast explains the two proportionality mechanisms. So for example, the notion of using information that's available to the entity without undue cost and effort. The webcast also illustrates how the mechanisms enable entities of varying sizes and levels of preparedness, including smaller companies and those in developing markets, to apply the standards. And it also provides examples of how to use proportionality when applying specific requirements in S1 and in S2. The fact sheet that accompanies the webcast is a great two-page guide that summarizes the mechanisms and the requirements and the standards to which they can be applied. So I think that's a really helpful resource for preparers to refer back to after watching the webcast.
Definitely. Sue, maybe you can talk about our Climate First materials.
Sure. So what we've said with the ISSB since it was first set up is that it's a climate first, but not climate only board. So sometimes I think people probably wonder what we mean when we say that. And it really means that we recognize that investors have a really urgent need for better information about climate related risks and opportunities and how that's going to affect businesses over the short, medium and long term. And we know that some preparers are responding to this investor demand by focusing their initial disclosure efforts on climate. But we didn't want to limit it at that. So you might know, people listening, that IFRS S1 asks for information about all of a company's important sustainability-related risks and opportunities. And we wanted to sort of bridge between this demand initially for climate information, but then the ultimate ask for information about other topics. And we did that by introducing transition relief into IFRS S1. And that's really relevant at the moment because there's several jurisdictions beginning in 2026 that will start by only requiring climate-related disclosures to be provided. And what our transition relief does is it makes it clear that when a company reports only on climate, which is fine, they can do that. They can just provide climate-related information consistent with what's required by IFRS S2, but they have to do that in the context of IFRS S1. So you need to pick up both standards, guys. So for example, the whole notion of materiality that underpins all of our standards, it's set out in IFRS S1. So you just can't apply IFRS S2 in isolation. So to help people understand what we mean when we say, you know, apply climate, but in the context of S1, we developed some guidance about doing exactly that, applying IFRS S1 when reporting only on climate-related disclosures in accordance with IFRS S2 to really help preparers to navigate it. So that guidance supports companies that are using the transition relief to report only on climate-related information. And it also explains how to comply with IFRS S1 in a climate-first way, where the focus is on IFRS S2 before broadening the disclosures out to other sustainability-related risks and opportunities over time. So Sarah, if I think about disclosures about climate, I guess one of the most frequently asked topics and areas of interest is, you know, the topic everyone loves to hate, disclosures about greenhouse gas emissions. So maybe it's good to talk about the materials we publish there to really try and help preparers with that important part of the disclosures.
Sure. Preparers can use our educational material that explains the greenhouse gas emissions disclosure requirements that are in IFRS S2. This is a Q&A style document that covers a number of specific topics, and more generally, it addresses common questions about the measurement and disclosure of GHG emissions in accordance with IFRS S2. It explains how to apply relevant aspects of the greenhouse gas protocol, which is referenced in I4SS2, and it includes illustrative examples in an appendix showing how an entity's organizational boundary can affect the GHG emissions disclosures for the reporting entity. The educational material was designed in this short, focused question and answer format to make this complex area easier to navigate in practice and to explain the relationship between I4SS2 and relevant parts of the GHG protocol materials. So another area that we've had a lot of interest in is the disclosure of information about companies' transition plans. Over to you.
Yeah, so what we decided to do was to build on the good work that had been done by the Transition Plan Task Force, or the TPT, which is now whose materials are now hosted on our Sustainability Knowledge Hub. And we decided to issue guidance branded by us on how to disclose information about an entity's climate-related transition, including information about their transition plans when they're using our standards. And the first thing to say here is that this doesn't change what I4SS2 already asked for, but rather it provides more color about the type of information about a company's plans either to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or their plans to improve their resilience to climate change that's relevant when you're applying I4SS2. So this guidance identifies the I4SS2 disclosure requirements that are relevant when you're thinking about disclosures about an entity's climate-related transition, provides some practical guidance and illustrative examples to support really meaningful and decision-useful information about transition planning. It follows the I4SS2 structure, so it goes through the pillars of governance, strategy, risk management, and metrics and targets. And it also includes a mapping between the requirements in I4SS2 and the elements of the TPT's disclosure framework to help entities to leverage the TPT's good practice guidance when they apply I4SS2. So hopefully lots of helpful stuff in there to reduce fragmentation and disclosures about transition plans and to make sure that investors get, you know, helpful decision-useful information when companies are using our standards.
Thanks, Stu. Greg, do you want to talk about our materials on anticipated financial effects next?
Sure. So although the connection of sustainability-related information with the financial statements is increasingly established, a perceived challenge that has surfaced in discussions with companies is around the disclosure of information about anticipated financial effects. This includes information that enables investors to understand the effects of sustainability-related risks and opportunities on a company's financial statements, that is, on the company's financial position, financial performance, and cash flows. And I4S S1 and S2 include a requirement to disclose information about both the current effects for the reporting period as well as the anticipated effects over time. So we have two resources available on this topic. First, there's a webcast series covering both current and anticipated financial effects requirements. And then second, we have written material that kind of focuses in more on the anticipated financial effects side of the requirement. So that education material, that written education material, summarizes the requirements and ISSB standards related to both current and anticipated financial effects. It also explains the relief mechanisms that are available to entities, including where estimation uncertainty is high, in particular, when it might be appropriate to provide qualitative rather than quantitative information about anticipated financial effects. And then it also includes a series of illustrative examples to explain how entities assess and prepare information about the anticipated financial effects, as well as how to apply the relief mechanisms in practice. Key takeaway is that providing information about anticipated financial effects while requiring the use of judgment can be approached in a practical, proportionate way. It need not be as daunting as some might initially fear. The ISSB was careful in drafting S1 and S2 to try and strike the right balance. We also remind that whereas some think that quantitative information about anticipated financial effects necessarily implies the need to model outcomes well into the future, that is not the case. For example, providing information about amounts in the next year's budget is an example of quantitative information about anticipated financial effects. So hopefully this education material kind of helps demystify some of the requirements around anticipated financial effects and help preparers as they begin their disclosures. Sarah, maybe we talk about one more piece of education material.
Sure. Why don't I talk about our materials on using ISSB industry-based guidance? We know investors need industry-specific information. That's why it's required when applying ISSB standards. To explain, for example, how climate-related risks and opportunities affect a company's future business model, it's really necessary to provide that information within the context of the company's particular activities. Because what is relevant for an airline will be really different to what is relevant for, say, a food producer. So ISSB standards refer to ISSB industry-based guidance to help companies. And we've developed educational materials to explain how to use this guidance. It focuses on the role of the SASB standards and the IFRS S2 industry-based guidance and what it means that an entity shall refer to and consider the applicability of ISSB industry-based guidance. The key points covered in this educational material include that entities must consider these sources, but they are not automatically required to apply them in full. It also talks about how industry-based guidance can be extremely helpful in identifying sustainability-related risks and opportunities to provide information about, and is helpful in determining what information about those risks and opportunities is likely to be material to disclose when applying IFRS S1 and IFRS S2. We encourage listeners to read the full document for a comprehensive understanding of how the industry-based guidance interacts with ISSB standards. As Greg mentioned, you can access all of these materials and more on the ifrs.org website under Application Support for IFRS Sustainability. So, educational materials are one pillar. The other big piece is responding to application challenges and questions. Can you walk us through how we are doing this?
Sure. So, we said when we established our work plan that we would put most of our time and energy into supporting the implementation of S1 and S2. So it really is front of mind for us all the time. And that's because we think it's a really important part of our job as standard setters, particularly with this new type of reporting, to really closely monitor how the standards are being applied in practice. And once we've issued them and they're out in the real world, to be responsive to application challenges when we need to be. So the educational materials that we've been talking about are an example of that. I think most of the materials that we've been talking about today have been inspired by questions that we were aware of that were coming up when entities were using the standards. But another good example of us standing ready to help when we need to is the series of targeted amendments to IFRS S2 that we completed at the end of 2025. And this is, just to flag, a really big deal for us to amend a standard, particularly early in its life. But we said that if it was necessary, we'd do it. And we decided that we should take the step. And these changes in S2, which relate to greenhouse gas emissions, don't come into effect sort of on a mandatory basis until 2027. But early application of these changes is permitted. So we wanted to make sure that these reliefs and clarifications that we'll talk through are available now, so that for those of you applying the standards out there, this help is available straight away if you need it. So just to talk about what we touched on here. So the amendments we made are very targeted, and they were specific to the greenhouse gas emissions disclosure requirements in IFRS S2. And the particular points that we addressed were informed by application questions that we received through our transition implementation group. So these amendments, which, as I said, were finalised and issued in December 25, aim to provide clarifications and reliefs and to address some really specific application challenges that were raised with us by preparers. So the amendments relate firstly to a particular category of Scope 3 indirect emissions, the Category 15 emissions on investments. And so we've made an amendment to S2 to make it really clear that an entity can limit the measurement and disclosure of its Scope 3 Category 15 greenhouse gas emissions to financed emissions, as that term is defined in IFRS S2. We also, in the sphere of financed emissions, have made an amendment to S2 to enable some different industry classification systems to be used to provide disaggregated information about financed emissions. If you are in the insurance industry or commercial banking industries, previously you had to use one particular system, the Global Industry Classification System, or GICS, and we got feedback that that was a harder ask than we'd anticipated. So those first two changes, the clarification on the scope of Category 15 and the industry classification adjustments, are really pertinent, particularly for those in the finance industry, although other companies can have Category 15 emissions as well. The other two things that we addressed are to do with jurisdictional reliefs. So trying to make sure that where there's particular jurisdictional requirements that relate to the measurement of greenhouse gas emissions, that we've provided relief to reduce the risk of duplication in effort when it comes to measuring greenhouse gas emissions. So the first of the changes here was to clarify that if you are subject to a jurisdictional requirement to measure greenhouse gas emissions, and that our measurement system does not use the greenhouse gas protocol standard, that you can use your jurisdictional approach. And that is the case even if only part of your entity is subject to that jurisdictional requirement. So that's a clarification that if you've got a subsidiary or a particular activity subject to that jurisdictional requirement, you can still stay with that measurement in your ISSB reporting. The other change we made was to extend the jurisdictional relief. We've got a very particular requirement in IFRS S2 about the global warming potential values that you need to use to measure greenhouse gas emissions. It was brought to our attention that sometimes jurisdictions are requiring a different value to be used, and we didn't want people to have to run those numbers twice. So we've extended the jurisdictional relief to say that if you have a requirement to use a different figure different from that in the latest IPCC assessment report, you can use that jurisdictionally required measure to measure your emissions when you're reporting using S2. So really targeted things that are really important if you're affected by them, and then many can ignore them, but are here to help, as we said. So as I mentioned, that's available now. So you can apply those changes, and they formally come into effect in 27, but we wanted to make sure that for those particularly in jurisdictions starting to report in 26, that these reliefs and clarifications would be available as soon as possible. So Sarah, I mentioned the wonderful transition implementation group there as a source of feedback that resulted in that targeted change to S2. So maybe a good moment for you to reflect on the most recent meeting of that group.
Sure. So the transition implementation group, also known as the TIG, is just another way we are staying close to implementation and application challenges and responding to them in a timely manner. While the amendments to IFRS S2 are an example of where it was clear we needed to address specific challenges that were highlighted via TIG discussions, the TIG also helps us to be confident when there isn't a need to make a change. Such was the case of our last TIG meeting in November 2025. The papers for this meeting can serve as a helpful resource as they set out implementation questions, as well as the staff analysis of the questions based on the requirements in S1 and S2. Ultimately, the summary of a meeting is also designed to be a useful educational resource to support understanding. There were three papers for that session. One, outlining questions that can be answered applying the existing words in ISSB standards. And then two papers, both dealing with GHG emissions related questions, our favorite topic, one on measuring and disclosing GHG emissions for groups with intercompany transactions, and another on scope 3 GHG emissions and the 15 GHG protocol categories. For those interested, please see the papers on our website for additional information and be on the lookout for the TIG summary paper, which we expect to publish in January. So we've covered a lot. I'm wondering, Greg and Sue, if you could share any final reflections and views on the year ahead. I'll start with you, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. Yeah, so for reflecting on our most recent work, I think we've really done a lot to set up preparers to be successful when implementing our standards for the first time. So as we've covered, we have a robust set of education materials covering many of the most challenging aspects of S1 and S2. And then we've also delivered targeted amendments to S2, providing important clarifications and reliefs around GHG emissions disclosures. And while we didn't cover in this episode, it's also worth reflecting that we've done a lot of work to maintain and enhance the SASB standards over the last year, which is really core to our implementation support work, as we noted in the context of our materials on industry-based guidance. The SASB standards play a very important role in helping entities apply the requirements. So looking into early 2026, it's worth flagging that we have a couple additional implementation support materials in the pipeline, including materials about requirements on scenario analysis and climate resilience assessment, as well as an update to our GHG emissions education materials to reflect recent amendments to S2 and address additional GHG-related questions that have arisen. These efforts are all about supporting preparers to move from understanding the standards to applying them in real reporting cycles. Sue, do you want to close us out by looking ahead to 2026 more broadly?
Sure. So 2026 will be an important year for us, a bit of a landmark, if you like, because we'll have, you know, several more significant jurisdictions beginning reporting in accordance with our standards, some for the first time and others continuing, such as those in Turkey. And as those jurisdictions come on board, we really plan to keep an eye on the reports that we see being published. It can be really helpful for us to highlight good practice, but also where we might need to provide additional materials to improve understanding and application. We expect that as more companies get into the weeds with application, that we're likely to get more implementation and application questions. So we stand ready for that, including through the TIG. And, you know, if needed, we'll act and provide further educational material. So we're going to be super interested to see what happens and to stand ready to help as we need to do. Another really important strand of work that we are looking at is our dialogue and close engagement and cooperation with the GHG Protocol, who are in the process of revising their corporate standards and guidance. Clearly, the GHG Protocol is really important for us because we require the use of the corporate protocol standard, subject to jurisdictional requirements. So we have a memorandum of understanding in place with the GHG Protocol to make sure that we are able to provide support as they revise their standards to help ensure that any changes that are made are really compatible with our investor focus on IFRS S2, and it's really clear how our relative materials interact. And we also want to help as they get ready for their public consultation on draft revisions next year. So we're deeply engaged in their processes there to really get to a good outcome for us both. And I think one thing I'd just note for the preparers that are listening is that don't think that as the GHG protocol makes changes that sort of automatically flows through to affect IFRS S2. We were really careful when we drafted S2 to refer to a specific version of the GHG protocol standard. So that means that any changes that the GHG protocol makes don't automatically or immediately affect application under IFRS S2. Any updates to the GHG protocol would require us to update the reference in IFRS S2, which would have to be subject to our full due process, including public consultation. So if and when the time is right to do that, you'll get to comment on whether what we propose makes sense from your perspective and what the application consequences would be. So all in all, I'd say that we can expect 2026 to be another busy and exciting year, supporting those starting to apply our standards, expanding further our suite of supporting materials when we need it, and really maintaining that strong focus on supporting everybody as they roll out the application of S1 and S2.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Implementation Insights. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to continuing to support you as you implement the ISSB standards in the year ahead.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Please contact us on communications@ifrs.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions. You can also sign up for email alerts on our website, ifrs.org, or find us on social media.